the Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. And the police here, in trying to remove the tents, were not trying to search or seize these plaintiffs. They were trying to get them to move, to go away. And instead of going away, they remained. And so the police resorted to the use of force, hands and batons, to move the plaintiffs out of the way so they could carry out their lawful duty of removing this illegal tent encampment. And the right asserted by the petitioners, the plaintiffs, is the right to prevent the police from doing that without getting pushed, without having a baton used on them.
I mean, obviously the police, what you told me, maybe this is their extreme petitioners, they might say the police just went in and just started cracking it with over instructions and batons to get the people out. You're not going to stand here and say that God would not, but that would be so.
Right.
So they're just, they're saying that the level of force used to get them out of the way was excessive. And you're now taking 6 minutes of your time to get to some water users that you should
be talking to. What is the evidence on the level of force used? Again, two types of conduct. Only two of the appellants here actually used any force at all.
That's not the administrators. That's why I started out by saying there are plenty of affidavits from the plaintiffs in which they say that officers used overhand strikes and in some cases to the head and the carriers.
Not by any of the
doesn't matter because the administrators, for the administrators, right, they authorized the officers to go and use force to get to those tents. And so that's what you need to address, it seems to me, is it's not only the conduct of the officers against
them. And what the record shows on that point, on the use of force, is that California has adopted a commission on police officer standards and trainings to deal with the use of force by police. It has standards that meet constitutional muster. That's the whole purpose of having this commission. The evidence is unrebutted on the record that the use of force by the police was in compliance with the post standards.
Because some of the plaintiffs say that they were hit in the head and neck area with batons, and that is not permitted under the post-standard.
There was no affidavit or any testimony in the record from on the plaintiff's side to rebut the expert testimony submitted by the defendants on compliance with the post-standards. There was expert testimony unrebutted. There was, as you say, plaintiff submitted an affidavit. I was hit in the head and the neck.
More than one, wasn't a sequence.
Certainly. But no description of the consequence or the level of force used in those strikes.
Was not permitted to strike someone in the head with a baton at this level of
physical force.
Yes, so there are affidavits and maybe a trial who all would be able to convince the jury that in fact he was just like tap on the head instead of a strike, but that's the disputed question right now, right?
Is there any other state of the evidence with respect to the use of force is that there is no medical record of any injury by any plaintiff. There is no
question. The concern is when there was authorization by the administrators that the police use force to remove to displace the encampment. Right.
Not quite correct, Your Honor.
What we're getting at is the authorization, as you say, and the direction that we're given by the administrators of the police. Does that mean that the administrators are accountable for whatever conduct that the police carry out?
Well, that's the allegation. And that's the alleged misconduct of the administrator defendants was a failure to act. But the evidence is that the administrator defendants called on the police to enforce the no camping regulation for very good reasons. This is a university campus.
Are you saying that
well, Section 1983 requires personal culpability. The cases on supervisory liability deal with situations where you have the supervisor observing the prison inmate being beaten or mistreated and failing to exercise the supervisory authority to stop it. In this case, you've got the university chancellor, a history professor, the communications officer, Claire Holmes, who have no responsibility for supervising the police. And the allegation is they have a constitutional duty to somehow tell the police exactly how much force to use on their batons. And
so the allegation from the plaintiffs is that the administrator folks basically said, under no circumstances, no circumstances whatsoever, are you to allow those kids to remain past tonight.
Right.
Yes. And that seems to carry with it a direction. Police, if I were an officer and I got that command, I would assume that means if I ever meet resistance, I'm going to have to overcome it by some kind of way, right?
Yes.
So there was no, the direction that the administrators gave, there was no calibration for, well, if you meet this level of resistance, then you're going to need to start using overhand sweeps of the batons on students. Maybe you should back off at that point. There was just a charge to the police to do whatever is necessary to overcome whatever resistance you meet.
No, whatever is necessary, because the administration specifically said, I don't want to see tear gas, I don't want to see pepper spray.
So that's not the same orders, because then you're only limiting the police to just the batons and guns.
Right.
That's all they have. And so you just charge them with whatever level of resistance you need, you must overcome it. Tell me what I'm missing.
Well, what you're missing is California has these post standards. The police are trained in the use of force, and there are appropriate levels of force used to overcome resistance. And in this case, it started out with verbal commands and an announcement to the crowd in general by Officer Tejada over the bullhorn. And then when the crowd failed to respond, the skirmish line moved in saying, move, move, move. And the evidence is undisputed that the plaintiffs here heard that and refused to move because they wanted to defend the tents. And so the constitutional principle that the plaintiffs seem to be advocating for is that they have a right to erect tents in violation of law and maintain them there in perpetuity. Because some level of force is required to overcome their resistance.
But let's say it's an extreme level of force that's going to be necessary given the circumstances. We're vastly outnumbered by the protesters. All we have are batons. We can't use tear gas. We can't use pepper spray. We need to just start cracking some heads because that's the only thing that's going to allow us to get to the test. That's all I'm saying is, how are the officers on the ground supposed to interpret the direction? Under no circumstances are those tests to be allowed to remain.
Remove the tents consistent with the use of force standards applied by the
zone.
And that's what happened.
So we clearly start having people who are presented with the batons and they don't move. You can't just go back to the station, right? Because we would have failed in our objective. So I guess, if I'm on the ground, I say, we need to escalate this because these people aren't responding to the moderate use of force, right? And I've been told I can't come back here without having removed those tents. So what am I supposed to do?
Overcome the resistance of the lawbreaker who is preventing the police from carrying out their constitutional legal duty to maintain this campus for the benefit of all students, all faculty, the public at large. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing unconstitutional about asking the police to enforce the law. And the alternative is mob rule, that they can erect this tent and defend it from the university in perpetuity. Like People's Park, it's been there for 40 years. They had this tree sit for 19 months. And the administration made a reasonable decision that this law should be enforced in this circumstance, and they asked the police to do so. And the police did so. They removed the tents. They were required to use some level of force to do so because of the illegal conduct of the protesters. And the evidence is that the force used didn't cause anyone any injury that required medical attention and was consistent with the standards of the California Police Officer Standard Training.
To be a simple question, in reading your briefs, I was focusing upon what the police officers did with using hands, pointing the baton. I understand that argument. that reads very well. And if they're going to link their arms and refuse to obey proper orders, that didn't seem to be much of an escalation. I think the problem is there's some evidence here by way of an affidavit or a declaration that head strikes were used, and that becomes something different. This is not a hard case if all you're doing is using hands and cleaning batons, but once head strikes occur. So tell me how the justification there of the administrators or even the police to use head strikes.
Well, first of all, the administrators, no administrator authorized or was aware of head strikes by anyone. This is something that was inserted into affidavits after the fact during the course of the civil litigation. I have divided my time with Mr. Perry, who's
answering my question.
And so the answer to your question is, if there were actual evidence of a head strike in violation of post standards, that would be excessive force under the circumstances. Yes. I submit there's not that evidence in this record. And the only question.
Did you just tell us there's a declaration in the record?
Yes, from two plaintiffs, Anderson and Uribe.
Right.
And it was only Uribe that made reference to, in one sentence, I was struck in the head and neck.
Okay, you said
something like
this.
Okay. Yes. So that may create an issue of fact as to the use of force by the individual plaintiffs, and that's certainly Mr. Perry's issue. And yes, and Tucker as well. The reason I'm saying is because I've used up
my 6 minutes on your relevant
stuff. We have not discussed that the administrator defendants, Your Honor, this very novel concept that university administrators have a duty to micromanage the police. When all they
want your client to answer the question, that's fine. Your co-counsel, that's fine. I think this is definitely what they're seeing to have.
Good morning, may it please the court, Russell Perry for Officer Lancer. I'm going to be really fast. I understand a lot of time has been used, so I'm going to try to zero right in and get back to the question I just asked. Regarding the UC administrators?
No, UC. I said, I understand everything about using hands and using it. That's not a question in my mind. The question in my mind is there's a declaration of a head strike.
That declaration is not applied to Officer Lashler. There's been no accusation of any strikes outside of the zone that was in the policy for her. All her strikes were two strikes within the forceful area as part of the policy for documentary and as lethal.
So I understand. And first of all, I ask what we do with an affidavit that says someone got a head strike.
They have the burden to identify that officer. They did not identify Officer Lashler at the opportunity when we saw.
So if the district court says, yes, there's something here, we have to go to trial to make that identification.
Well, the opportunity for that was during the discovery phase, and to identify Officer Lashler's made a district, but there's been no accusation.
Officer Lashler, I understand you represent her. I'm asking a different question.
Right.
What do we do with a declaration that says there was a head strike?
Well, if there's a chief of fact, the issue for us on appeal is qualified immunity. So we're also looking at cases, even if you find that there's a constitutional violation, we have to point to the cases that show that it was clearly established at that time. And we have to look at the facts of the case.
You're talking about the second call?
Yes, that was the court, the Supreme Court, in Whiteley policy. You need to identify a case where an officer acting under every single circumstance is violated the Fourth Amendment, and the cases relied upon by the district court are not similar to the facts of this case at all. The cases cited were Peavey versus Koch, which involved what's known as this case, involved a principal that smacks 1,000 kids and puts their hands in the locker and was actually charged with battery. Totally different facts than what we're dealing with today. The district court also cited the Headwaters case, which we're all familiar with, but that all did involve massive crowd control. It involved 6 to 7 protesters and some pepper spray, not the batons, and there was other means that was all applied force. There was a grinder, and there was, there was clay and the sand for the pepper spray, so there were other issues. It's not just actually similar to our case. And finally, the other case, the district court also found out it was found versus County of Los Angeles, and that one involved a staffer. And it was the driver came out of the car and had to disobey orders to get back into the car, and he preferred to sit on the curb, and the officer ended up applying pepper spray on top of him, and then used the baton strikes, eight smacks in the head. And that case is totally different from what Officer Flanagan is showing.
Okay. You can run the cross. But the key question I will do with it, I believe, is that your argument that some lawyers from your side should tell me, in this case, there is some evidence, whether it was a lie or not, but there is some evidence in a declaration that it was a head strike. So what do we do with that?
I don't know when we apply the last year, and I don't know how it comes to be. I don't want to speak for on behalf of the defense. I don't represent. I would defer to
Mr. Gray's deferring across this room on this one. It seems to me that someone should have an answer. I have an answer that I have an answer, but I wanted to get your point of view. Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Do you have anything else on the Dr. Clay?
I just wanted to point out that these situations are very dangerous times for officers when they're facing the mass crowds. It's a very difficult time, and the situation that my officer had to deal with was people grabbing her baton, people pressing back, and she was not close. And it's dangerous for officers because if those batons can be thrown over, they can be used against them. If their firearms get taken away from them, if it's an active resistance crowd, so there's an urgency once you are face-to-face there, and then the two strikes aren't working in the crowd, and they're still chained up. It does escalate when there's pushback, and it turns into a very different situation once they're face-to-face, and there's no evidence of complying with orders. And my friend acted reasonably that day, and if there was a finding that she did not act reasonably, I would argue that there was not a case on point at that time to establish the flaws of the situation that then.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's hear from Counselor Fletcher, so we'll give you some time to report more.
Is anybody else in the argument? Is looking very good.
Good morning. Please, the court. My name is Tanya Driver. I'm the lawyer representing the 21 plaintiffs who are UC Berkeley students. Staff, alumni, and in the case of one exception, a University of Michigan alumni rather than a UC Berkeley alumni.
Could you tell me, I'm working on this affidavit, or declaration by one of the individuals who said that they had a head strike. Are you representing that person?
I am, thank you.
What does the declaration say?
There are several declarations.
The one person that talked about the head strike.
There's more than one person that talks about a head strike. But there are at least three people who talk about receiving a head strike. In the case of Officer Lackler, she goes through in her deposition and to a very clear and great extent what the policy of UCPD was, the University of California Police Department was, and the use of force in situations like this. And she says included in that policy is a command for officers to avoid the areas of the heart, the groin, and the kidney.
Wait a What does the declaration say? The person was struck. What does it say?
The case of Officer Lackler? And the question is?
No. I'm going back to your client. What is your client alleged in this declaration or affidavit about a hand strike?
That one client says that he was hit in the face with a baton. Another client says that he was hit with an overhead swing to the head.
And do they identify who the police officers are?
They do.
And what are their names that they identify?
That may take me a second.
Well, some of them are not defendants of this appeal. I refer a call from the Alameda County Sheriff's Office, but there's one of your clients says that this Sergeant Tucker has been struck in the head. That's the only one I remember of the defendants who are in this case. I don't think anyone ever says that. Nobody says that Officer Plaster hit him with a hand, right?
Right. So there's no, they just said that they were hit with a groin, however, and that is.
Well, your clients are kind of at cross purposes there, because the person who supposedly was hit in the groin has asked them, says, I have no recollection of that. Somebody else is referring to you. What is that? I think we go with that. The person who's actually been there, he says, or I can't remember that. So I don't need your help there. But just confirm for me that you don't have any evidence in the record that Officer Lashley struck anyone in the head with Harbison, do you?
We do not. I think whether, I think the question, well, in terms of whether her use of force was excessive or not is a jury question. That's up to a jury to decide. If a jury thinks that under those circumstances, the behavior of the police officer constituted excessive force because the police officer and all of the police officers did not avail themselves of trying to use other means to clear the crowd, that there wasn't a clear dispersal order, that there weren't exit, there weren't ways for people to exit safely who wanted to exit, then yeah, then I think that that's a question for a jury to decide.
How is the jury going to decide that? The determination isn't whether or not they did these acts. The determination and the problem, too, is that it was unconstitutional at that time, so they were not warned. Your cases don't show that.
I think that the officers were aware that they're being
told. The name of the case is most important to you to show that at the time it happened, there was a case that demonstrated that they were violating the rights, constitutional rights, of your clients.
I think the most important case is the Headwaters Forest.
Headwaters is your closest?
Yes. I think that they're, I think that for the police to be able to make a claim that they're unaware that their behavior might result in constitutional violations that include excessive force, and that they should be conscious and aware how to defend it is, I just can't imagine how they can claim that. It's their own police manuals, their own operational plan for the day. Makes clear that
there's no case that says that statistics that doesn't say that you have to show any case by the court that it was a violation of the Constitution at that time. It doesn't matter whether we think they should have been doing better. That's not the issue.
Judge, it is true that they are supposed to show a case, but it is also true that the court has filed, the Supreme Court repeatedly, that the facts don't have to be identical, that there might be novel cases in which questions of liability are being considered.
I think you've indicated that Headwaters is your best case.
I think the other cases that we cite are about Kansas.
Can I ask you about these intruder defendants?
Mm-hmm.
So help us with the analysis there. Looking at it from their standpoint, they say, fine, yes, we made it clear we want
warrant was just removed. But we assumed, rightly so, that the officers would use force within the confines of that result. And so we certainly told them, start grabbing some heads with your batons if you need resistance when there isn't that. We said, do what you have to do within the guidelines that are provided, and that did not include. So if anyone went outside of that and started hitting people in the head with overhand strikes, often the administrator defense would say, we never authorized that. We had no idea that they were going to do that. So how can we be held liable for what these other officers did?
The administrators in this case constituted an emergency management team whose job it was to make sure that there was civilian supervision and police supervision of the police tactics used on that day. That whole team decided to leave campus at 7 p.m. knowing full well that there had been 5 arrests earlier in the day and that one person had been hospitalized earlier in the day due to the police tactics.
Let's break it up into two parts. So are you conceding that there's no liability on their part for what happened to the union? Because you could not have predicted
No, I'm not conceding that because the people that start with that.
So start with it's 3 o'clock, 3:30, whatever time it is.
4:30 and 7.
4:30, okay, 4:30. So why are they liable for what happens in the evening?
Because they state to the police that the police must do whatever is necessary to take down those tents immediately. And in doing so, they're commanding the police to use any means necessary to take down those tents. They state, the chancellor states, that the police are not allowed to use pepper spray or tear gas in order to achieve that. And so there's definitely specific management of the police tactics that this administrative body is taking. The administrators make a point of saying that they were absent at the moment that the police action took place. They were conveniently only on site and only witnessed things in what they considered to be the so-called peaceful part of the protest. After the students took a vote to put up tents, there was no administrator to be found. Their job was to be there. Their job was to prevent what happened that afternoon. What would happen that day?
You're saying it was the administrator's job to actively manage the police?
Yes, that was their job. And they knew that from two sources. Okay, first of all, that's in their fundamental policies and part of their occupation, part of their plan for that day. But also, they had been through a long review process of a similar event that had occurred in 2009. And there was a commission that issued a report, and in that report it said, among other things, in order to avoid the potential of excessive force and liability, in order to make sure that the Graham test is being applied, it is essential that administrators, not just the police, are making the tactical decisions and reviewing them as they're happening about what should be taking place. They had fair notice of what it was that they were supposed to be doing, and they absolutely just neglected their duty to carry out the responsibilities that they had assumed when they became the crisis management team.
Was that their title, crisis management team?
Yeah, crisis management team, close, yes, one of their titles. The name changes a little bit, but it's crisis management team is one of them. So the whole thing's the 5-minute administration with executive attention.
So one administrator was out of the country. His responsibility is to get on a plane and come back.
He asserted his authority in the situation through a series of emails that he used to communicate with the crisis management team in terms of what he thought needed to be done.
I have a simple question. The simple question was, he has to get on a plane and come back. So to the White Home at 4:30 and 7, They stayed in contact, as I understand, by email of what's going on.
They did not say that.
They didn't. Oh, I'm sorry. It was in the briefs. I didn't search the record on that issue. Someone was misleading me. Your view is that they cannot delegate to the police that you are to act this way. The police have their own way, their own settlement. And so, because somebody says, and by the way, don't use pepper spray, they therefore are indicating that they are going to be responsible for anything the officers do at this point.
They are responsible for the deaths. They are responsible for the actions that the police took. Their job was to determine what level of force would be used, what level of negotiations would be employed, what immediate might mean. The chancellor is.
Where do we get that assignment? Is it in a record?
It is in a record.
And it came from what?
It came from their own discussions about what their operational plan would be, and it came with their agreement to follow the recommendations of what is called the Brazil Report, which was the report that looked at the prior event on campus in which there was outrage by the campus on the use of force by the police. So they've undertaken a specific responsibility, which they abandoned. And they, every single, I'll give you an example, the testimony of the administrators in this case defies any kind of notion of, unless they're completely incompetent, it defies any notion of credibility. One of the members of the CNET was a woman named Claire Holmes, who was responsible for all of the media communications that the university would have with the outside world. She has her staff assigned that day to look at all of the video footage, to pick up tweets, to look at the news coverage. She knows when she leaves campus that there are news helicopters overhead. Her claim is that she did not see the videos or knew what the police did directly from her own observation until 10 p.m. at night when she returns from an Eagle Scout meeting and turns on the TV, and then she's appalled to see what it is the police did. I don't think anyone can believe that testimony.
You never know what jury's going to do.
It's up to a jury, though, Judge.
Tell me what cases you cited that's a violation of a constitutional right that she would be aware of on the date of the occurrence. She's at the headwaters again.
Well, it's Forrester v. San Diego. It's Gravlin, Blondin v. Shelton.
Are you reading from a list? I take it. Could you tell me what those cases hold?
Yeah. They hold that, well, let's start with, that there's a debate about whether or not the actions of the protesters was constituted active or passive resistance. And Forrester describes an incident in which a police officer approaches a driver who's been pulled over, asks him to get out of the car, please, and place his hands on his head and walk towards the officer. And the person in the car fails to do so. He starts screaming, he starts tapping his legs, he sticks in the car, he eventually gets tasered, and the court found that that was excessive force. And in Forrester, it's a case in which there are a group of Operation Rescue members who are sitting in front of an abortion clinic, and they go in, and they are refusing to vacate the space that they're in. They are being nonviolent in their actions, but the court looks at the balance between the rights of the individuals to stay there and the right of the police and the state interest involved in moving those demonstrators so that it's possible for women to get into that clinic, for doctors to provide medical services, for the clinic directors to be able to carry out their activities. And the court finds that, yes, under those circumstances, it was correct for the police to go in and to remove those demonstrators because there was the imbalancing between the state interest and the interest of the individual. The court concluded that the state interest justified what the police did. So, I don't know if you want me to continue.
That's fine, thank you.
I would just say that there's a reason why the counsel for the administrators cannot defend and so does not try to defend their actions in this case and attempts to obfuscate the issue or to place the burden on the individual police officers and what their conduct might have been. And in this case, it's like the administrators are these, you know, ski racers going down a slope. And they're on a slope, of course. And they get instructed that if they stay within the gates, then they can't be held liable for what occurs on that, for their own performance on that day. So they want to make sure that they are not present when some of the brutality takes place so they can say, A, we didn't see it, and B, we couldn't stop it because we weren't there. And it's just so dishonest.
So help me with this, if you're able to point to specific things in the record. Let's assume that the administrators were entitled to believe at the outset that the officers would not use what might constitute excessive force, that they would use the baton in an appropriate way. At what point did the administrators, in your view, become aware that excessive use of the baton was being engaged in? Specific knowledge that they were told, you know, or saw videos. What do you have in the record that speaks specifically to that?
Now, there isn't. I think the only thing that's in the record that speaks specifically to that is the creation of the hub, which is the center where all of the administrators are supposed to be, which is getting continuous live feeds from what is taking place on the campus. And all of the administrators say that they didn't see something while it was taking place, including in the afternoon. And the first time they became aware was what a student told them, or they heard it from somebody else. But they're sitting in this hub. They're getting continuous feeds. It's such an incredulous stance to take that they didn't see what was happening. Why did they create this hub?
These are the videos that you, I think, gave us on DVD. Are they properly before us? Did they get excluded?
They did not get excluded, Judge. They are not among the videos that got excluded.
Oh, I see. Okay, and you're saying that you have evidence that whatever we have on the DVD, the folks were watching it in real time.
I can only say this, that what is on those DVDs went viral. By the evening, tens of thousands of people had seen those videos. The only people who hadn't, apparently, were the administrators in this case. You know, they had the most direct and immediate interest in reviewing those videos. So, no, there isn't evidence that they saw those videos, but they saw something. And if they didn't see anything, then they are, you know, people to be held responsible as supervisors because of their clear incompetence and their unwillingness to be able to take the slightest responsibility for the actions that were going on, which it was their responsibility to control. Thank you.
Let's give 3 minutes for rebuttal. Just on the administrator point, the proposition we submit is there's no constitutional duty on the part of the administrators to allow mob rule on campus and to violate the law with respect to the Lieutenant Cammon just because there's a mob there wanting to do that. And as a thought exercise for the panel,
imagine that it wasn't Occupy Wall Street. Imagine it was the alt-right. Imagine it was Nazi sympathizers who wanted to come and set up the tent. The administration, it's their responsibility to maintain the campus for the use of all. With respect to the Officer Tucker, the question that was asked, that I stumbled on, that's the first part, the statement in the record with respect to being hit in the head comes from Plaintiff Anderson only, Jocelyn Anderson, is ER 1623-1624. And what he describes is the police pushed us further down the grass. The officer in front of me at the time, Officer Kinney, ran the end of his baton into my ribs and shoved us along with other officers. He hit me repeatedly 2 to 3 times and also pushed me, reference video 23. Then another very tall officer, Officer Tucker, hit me in the neck and face with his baton 3 times. That's it.
That's not permissible. You can see that that is not allowed.
What is
under this level of resistance that the officer's face
for? What is missing from what this? I understand Your Honor's reaction.
Am I wrong on that?
Well, yes, because there is nothing in the record to describe the context of this encounter, what Anderson was doing with Officer Tucker at the time, the level of resistance that Mr. Anderson was engaging in.
Jury question. You want to take that position. They're saying, my guy was standing there and someone just clocked him in the head with a baton, and that's not permitted. So someone has to resolve that dispute with themselves.
This is qualified immunity. Point one is excessive force. Excessive force is always a spectrum of what's the level of resistance being mounted by the plaintiff, perpetrator, and what level of force is being used. And what is missing from the plaintiff's submission is that part of the equation.
Underlying disputed facts that need to be resolved before we can figure out whether the officer is entitled to qualified immunity, correct?
He has to address either prong first.
If the facts turn out to be that the plaintiff Anderson was standing there not engaged in any kind of violent resistance to the officer, and the officer hit him in the head with a baton, the jury could find that that was excessive force, and the officer might not be entitled to qualified immunity for that, right?
Under that hypothetical set of facts, which is not this case, because
we don't know. That's my point. We don't know what version of the facts is correct, because no one has started the case yet.
So we don't know whether or not the force used was actually excessive on the for prong one analysis. And on prong two analysis, plaintiff's burden and the Schaffer versus Padilla case, which we cited from just 6 weeks ago.
The water balloon case.
Yes, at UC Santa Barbara, where there was a jury finding that the force used actually had been excessive. And the ruling of this court was the officer was nevertheless entitled to qualified immunity because it was a challenging environment and there was no case law on point directing that this particular use of force against this particular plaintiff was excessive.
Okay, and I think you're getting to the point, which was what I've been trying to find out. Assume for the sake of argument that the jury's going to find that the police officer used a baton and hit him in the head. Assume that. That's prong one, eight prongs. That's step one. Step two, which if we knew what we were doing when we wrote these opinions, would be step one instead of step two. Step two is, was there a case that would show that it would be a violation of constitutional rights at that time when he actually went for a human head? So there has to be showing of such a case. And I think that you disagree that there is such a case.
None has been cited in the record. In the district court, the place didn't even brief qualified immunity, and there's a reason for briefs, which is why we included the briefs in the record. And on this appeal, no case has been cited. We cited in our case the unpublished decision of Meggs versus City of Berkeley, where there was a police service line established where people can set a fire in the street, and the police used batons against a protester who was trying to breach the service line. So the nature of the jurisprudence is that the police are authorized to use some level of force.
And just to tell you, the that act of citizen disciplinary action to 12 suspension, because in 2011, correct, so when that's happened, it was clearly established that you cannot use potentially deadly force, which is not a job strike, but that is potentially deadly force, right?
You agree with that?
It depends on the level of force. That's why we have a factual dispute, because they're saying, I got clocked in the head with a baton, and maybe that's not what happened. Maybe it was a difficult tap. And yeah, okay, we don't know, but if it was getting clocked in the head with a baton, that is potentially deadly force, right?
And another
example, so it was clearly established in 2011 that you can, an officer cannot use potential deadly force on someone who is not persisting, right? They have to care for their lives, work in safety, or use that level of force. And if, in fact, the person was not engaged in that kind of conduct, it would be clearly
existing. It is the plaintiff's burden on summary judgment to establish that there is an issue of fact for trial and to overcome qualified immunity by showing a clearly established precedent. And all that we have here is this one sentence out of this voluminous record where one plaintiff says, met another very tall officer, Officer Tucker hit me in the neck and face with his baton 3 times. Doesn't say he cracked me in the head. We know he didn't require medical attention.
Thank you very much. The case is starting to be submitted. We are reserved for decision.